From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we discuss the real meaning of breast cancer awareness and the action that should follow.
Being aware is doing regular breast exams, being aware of what your body feels like, so that if there is a change, you're more likely to detect it sooner than later and taking the right steps.
Then we talk to a Madison photographer who spent 6 years documenting Iceland's melting glaciers.
The main reason I wanted to do this exhibition is every single one of us in the world is impacted by this. And everyone in this world is contributing to it as much as they would not want to. We are.
Plus, Shorewood High School grad Kate Baldwin talks about her life in lights on Broadway. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which you may already know. The breast cancer awareness movement has been incredibly successful. Many organizations have cashed in on it. You can buy everything from t-shirts and mugs to cookies or makeup sponges, all in the pink hue associated with the movement. But to some, the pink and pretty elements to this movement belie the painful and sometimes deadly realities of having breast cancer. Dr. Amanda Kong and Dr. Laura Field are two people who regularly deal with breast cancer patients. Dr. Kong is an associate professor of surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin and its section chief for breast surgery. Dr. Field is an assistant professor of radiology at Frederick Hospital, and she starts by explaining how common breast cancer is in this country.
Every year, about 250,000 to 300,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer. About 40,000 will die from breast cancer every year. So it's one of the largest cancers that affect women.
It's actually the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women. It's not the number one cause of death from cancer. The number one cause of death is actually lung cancer, if you look at the national statistics, but it is the most commonly diagnosed.
What does that look like in Wisconsin specifically?
There's approximately 5,000 women who are diagnosed with cancer in Wisconsin every year, and approximately 700 to 800 deaths annually.
You know, one of the things you mentioned is that although many women get breast cancer, it's not the number one killer among women, even though it might be the number one thing that is diagnosed. Why is that?
I think it's because breast cancer is a very dynamic cancer in the sense that every year the treatments are changing. There are two huge meetings, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO, which is in June, and then the San Antonio Breast Symposium in December. And everyone waits for those two meetings because the treatments for breast cancer are constantly changing. Even I've been in practice for a little over a decade, and even some of the surgical procedures we're doing have changed. You don't see that kind of change with lung cancer or some other cancers that are treated out there.
With screening mammography, we're able to fairly easily detect breast cancers, often at a treatable stage. The majority of breast cancers that we find are treatable. Whereas for lung cancer, up until recently, there really hasn't been a good way to do any kind of screening. There is now a good method of screening for lung cancer. And for people who are smokers, I do recommend they avail themselves of that. It can really make an impact.
But I think actually people probably aren't even aware of the screening available for lung cancer.
Right. It's a relatively new thing, and it hasn't been taken advantage of to the extent it really should, because there's not as much that can be done for lung cancer. It's usually found much later. Breast cancer, there's a lot more treatments. We can usually find it earlier.
As you say, you know, there's a lot of attention given to the different ways that you can screen for breast cancer. Can you go over some of those?
Well, the gold standard is screening mammography, which generally involves two projections, two different views of each breast. A lot of attention lately has been given to what many people call 3D mammograms, which is very similar, but instead of just taking two pictures, it takes about 15 smaller images and then is able to reconstruct them and present them to the reading radiologist as 1 millimeter thick slices. So we're able to separate overlying structures much easier and get a much better chance of seeing something. I liken it to if a person is standing behind a tree, you're not going to necessarily see them from one direction. But if you can peek around the tree, and that's what this allows you to do, then you can separate that person out from that. So the main tool that we use for screening that has been around for probably since the 1980s is screening mammography. In addition, for women who are high risk, there are other techniques available. Breast MRI is the most sensitive. In some places also do screening breast ultrasound. And there are some other forms of screening that are on the horizon that aren't quite being used yet, but will be.
Now, my family has a gene mutation which makes us more likely to develop breast cancer. When I've gone to geneticists, they've specifically told me because I'm under 30, because I'm under the age that they generally suggest for people to start getting mammograms, they've said it was a good idea to get an MRI. Is that a standard recommendation that if you are somebody who has a higher risk of developing breast cancer, which is premenopausal at a younger age, do they suggest that you get that kind of screening?
Yes. So it is recommended that by age 30, women who might have strong family histories should get some kind of risk analysis. And if they are found to be at high risk for breast cancer, then screening breast MRI is what's recommended. Usually, we don't start screening women before age 25 in general, but some women by age 25 are getting screening MRIs and even some alternating with mammograms because they do detect different things.
Well, in the case of my sister, she had breast cancer by the time she was 26, so.
I'm sorry.
But I will say, actually, with that in mind, as a woman who was about 25, 26, she had a very hard time getting a mammogram. And I've heard this from other women who are young and have developed these kinds of cancers, that it can be very difficult to get a mammogram. Why is that? Are there hoops that people have to jump through in order to get a mammogram?
Well, if you're not in the screening population age group, or if you have a lump, you're not going to be in the screening population. So if you have a lump or focal pain or some other particular problem that might indicate a breast cancer, you need to start by seeing your physician. And at that point, if your physician and you decide that some additional evaluation is needed, they would put an order in for a diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound usually to follow, depending on the situation. Usually for women under 30, we start with ultrasound, but it all depends on the situation. So if a person has a lump, they should see their doctor if they feel something.
Well, and that gets to another question that I have that I think a lot of women have. What are the symptoms of breast cancer? If you're someone who is worried whether or not you have a proclivity toward breast cancer, what are some of the symptoms that you might see?
So typically, breast cancer is actually found most often on screening mammography. As Dr. Field said, we're catching more cancers earlier and earlier. So I would say in the postmenopausal or even over 40 crowd, the cancers we find are really screen detected. I would say in the younger crowd, so less than 40 who are not being screened, it's usually a palpable mass that the patient will feel in the shower or in bed, or even oftentimes their partner will actually find it. But other than that, usually besides feeling something, cancer doesn't really cause pain unless it's growing through your skin or very large and compressing something. You don't have fevers. Sometimes the skin may turn a little red if it's pressing up against the skin. Occasionally, you might see nipple discharge, but that is not common. So really, it's a painless mass.
Yeah. A lot of women will come in, especially in the under 40 crowd, who feel a lump, their doctor feels a lump. Most of the time, that's going to be innocent. It's very common to have cysts and these growths called fibroadenomas in that age group, and they can be palpable. So the first thing somebody thinks when they feel a lump is, oh my gosh, they have breast cancer, but women under 40 should still get it checked out. But the first thing is most likely to be is going to be something simple and innocent, not something horrible.
So when it's not innocent, when it is something that is a cancer, what are the next steps? And I know this is an answer that kind of varies based on the stage.
The first thing that'll generally happen if a woman feels a lump and she comes in and she'll have a a mammogram and or an ultrasound, and we'll find an abnormality that needs the next step. And the next step is to get a sample of it and send it to the lab. That's done through a needle biopsy almost always these days. That's an outpatient procedure. It's relatively simple. Everything is done clean. It's not in the OR. It's just done outpatient. The skin and the deeper tissues are numbed up, just like if you went to the dentist. So there's a little pinprick and some burning. And then a needle is placed while we can watch the imaging to guide it exactly into the right spot. We collect a few samples. We leave a little marker clip behind so we know exactly where those samples came from. And then those samples go to the lab. And then depending on what the results are, the next step may be to visit with a surgeon.
So by the time the patient ends up in my office, they usually have a diagnosis of cancer. I'll take a complete history from them. And if there's anything suggestive of perhaps a genetic cause, I'll refer them to genetics. But the important thing to know is that 90% of breast cancer is sporadic. Only 10% is genetic. So it's actually a very small proportion of people who actually have a genetic cause for their cancer. After taking a complete history, I'll do a physical exam on them and review their images. And so typically I'm looking to see if I can feel the mass. If it's screen detected, I usually don't feel anything. I'll look to see how large their breast size is relative to the size of the tumor, because that will help with surgical planning. I also feel for the lymph nodes. And if I feel anything suspicious in their armpit, because most of the time breast cancer goes to the armpit first if it's going to spread, I may refer the patient back to radiology to get a biopsy of their lymph nodes to see if it's involved. Patients will often ask me, well, aren't you going to scan me from head to toe to see if I have cancer anywhere else in my body? And typically we don't do that unless we know it's spread to the lymph nodes. So if we know that there's lymph node involvement, then we will scan them from head to toe. And that usually consists of a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and a bone scan. Most patients do not present with nodal involvement, only about 20 to 25% do on presentation. So most people, it's actually contained in the breast. So if that's the case, then we discuss surgical planning at that point.
Now, I know there are a lot of different options if you do go the route of surgery and reconstruction ultimately. And, you know, I know this largely from my sister working on these kinds of cancer hotlines. A lot of women are very concerned about having breast, about losing their breast, about really what life looks like before and after, and largely the after. What are the options for women who are afraid of losing their breast?
So I always like to tell patients they're basically two different operations. So you can take out part of your breast or all of your breast. So one option is a lumpectomy, and it's often accompanied by radiation therapy. And the reason why we give radiation therapy is if we do a lumpectomy and we send someone out on the street and we don't give them radiation, the likelihood of a recurrence within 5 years is about 30%. So one in three, it's pretty high. If we look at contemporary data, if we give radiation, it drops it down to about 6%. That's significant. And I know many people will often be scared of radiation therapy, but there's a lot of new technology, not just in radiology, but in radiation therapy, that will spare the dosage to the heart and lungs. That's what most people are afraid of. So we've come quite far in that field. The other option is removal of the whole breast or a mastectomy with or without reconstruction. And I think an important thing to know is that I think many patients think, well, I just want to live, remove my whole breast. And we know from over 20 years of data that lumpectomy and radiation and a mastectomy are equivalent in terms of survival. And the way I frame that with my patients now is, because I think it's very hard for people to wrap their head around that, is when we hear people die of breast cancer, it's not because it comes back in the breast or the chest wall, but it goes to other sites, their liver or their bones, and surgery can't really prevent that. It's only there to remove the gross disease. But in terms of a mastectomy, patients will often want reconstruction or no reconstruction. I know that the New York Times actually had published a series of an article about how people are going flat now. So that's an option for some people. And when they want to go flat, they can have a prosthesis. But if you want reconstruction, there are many options now. We used to just do skin-sparing mastectomies where we preserve the skin envelope and take the nipple and the areola with the breast. But now we're doing nipple-sparing mastectomies where we hide the incision along the underwire of a bra, along that fold of the breast. And you can have reconstruction with either an implant or with your own tissue. And most commonly at our institution, we'll do something called the DIEP flap, or the deep inferior epigastric flap. And what that is essentially is you end up with a tummy tuck. They take the fat off your belly that you would get with a tummy tuck, except they dissect out the vessels that feed that paddle of fat, and they plug it into the vessels underneath your breastbone, and they form a breast. And it's very natural looking because it's your own tissue and it is fat. And not everyone's a candidate. It's like the Three Little Bears. You can't be too skinny. You can't be too heavy. You have to be just right. And I think our plastic surgeons are really good at determining that. And, you know, you'll often find that option at a high volume center because it does require someone who's highly trained in microvascular surgery.
You know, I think we hear this term, breast cancer awareness, quite a lot. And I think that has a lot of meanings to different people. But for both of you, what do you think breast cancer awareness is, and what do you think the importance is of it?
Well, breast cancer awareness is taking action to have your mammograms annually. We can't find breast cancer if you don't have a mammogram. If we don't look, we can't find it. So taking the attitude that if I don't go to the doctor, everything is fine. I'm feeling a lump. I'm going to ignore it. It's nothing wrong. That's being unaware of a problem. Being aware is doing regular breast exams, being aware of what your body feels like, so that if there is a change, you're more likely to detect it sooner than later, and taking the right steps.
You know, I'd like to echo what Dr. Field says. And I would say, in addition to being aware of your own body and detecting a cancer in yourself early, I think breast cancer awareness is just being generally aware that it is the most commonly diagnosed cancer in women, and reminding other women that this is important. Your mother, your sister, your friend, I'm too busy to get my mammogram. No, you're not too busy. It's painful. And, you know, it may not be comfortable, but this is your life. And it's being aware of what treatments are available and what we're doing in terms of research and supporting that, whether it's, you know, through any of the various foundations nationally or in your hometown institutions. You know, those are just important things, and that's how we've made all the strides we have in terms of treatment.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Kong, Dr. Field, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joy.
Dr. Amanda Kong is an associate professor of surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin and its section chief for breast surgery. Dr. Laura Field is an assistant professor of radiology at Frederick Hospital. You can find more of our coverage of medical issues at WUWM.com. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll learn about a new art exhibit in Milwaukee that explores Iceland's shrinking glaciers. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin native Michael Knitz is an award-winning photojournalist whose career was sparked by the Vietnam War. Knitz was studying at UW-Madison during the war, and he says he was struck by the contrast between the protesting he saw around him and how it was reported in the newspapers. So he picked up a camera and never put it down. Since then, Knitz has captured everything from children in war-torn countries to his work here in Milwaukee, where he chronicled images of homes and people in conjunction with the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Evicted by Matthew Desmond. For the last 6 years, his lens has turned to another dramatic scene: Iceland's vanishing glaciers. They currently cover an estimated 11% of the country, but they're shrinking. An exhibit titled Iceland's Vanishing Beauty recently opened in the Arts at Large Gallery on Milwaukee's near south side. Lake Effect Susan Ben spoke with Knitz as the show was about to open.
There's basically three aspects to why I got so enamored with this project. The first one being, in 2013, I was walking on this gravelly, rocky area with who I've since come to learn is probably the best guide in Iceland, Einar Runar Sigurdsson. He's the first one to go into the ice caves and take people to the ice caves. He's climbed the highest peak over 300 times in Iceland. He's just a fantastic guide, and we're so lucky to have become friends. He and I were walking to an ice cave, and quite a distance away, he pulled out his iPhone and said, "What do you think of this?" And it was the most stunningly beautiful ice cave. The color, everything was just... And I said, "That is unbelievable. Where is that?" "Well, that's where you're standing right now." And it was nothing but rock. It had completely vanished. Some of these photographs we're going to talk about today have been, the ice caves in particular, have been around for a few years, but their disappearance was 18 months or less. It was just incredible. Some less than a year. Massive, 100-yard caves that just had completely vanished.
So may I ask, how were you able to, financially, how were you able to do this work?
It was quite a trick. The most helpful thing was I was producing videos for a museum in Southeast Iceland. Now, that museum kind of has two goals. One, to introduce people to, well, what was the culture of Iceland like, as long as a couple hundred years ago or since photography, because it's largely based on photography and also little dioramas and life-size models. For example, that people slept right above the cows, so the cow heat would warm where they were sleeping and things like that. So the fact that this person, there was an author involved with the museum in the sense of they were telling his story as well as the overall story of Iceland. The Icelandic Writers Union was kind enough to give me a house in the winter about 15 minutes from most of these things, besides the areas we had to hike to. So for 2 months solid, I could be there working. And that's the only way you can really come away, and that happened 2 years in a row. That's the only way you can really come away with imagery like this because of the dramatic weather and other things which play a part in whether you're going to get these images or not.
So your upbringing, your winters in Wisconsin trained you for this kind of...
Perfectly, and I'm glad you brought that up. Because of the Gulf Stream in Southeast Iceland, sometimes when I would call back to Madison, it was 40 degrees warmer in Iceland than Madison. And people are always saying, "Well, what about the weather in Iceland? How did you deal with it?" Well, Wisconsin winter is an excellent preparation because, quite honestly, it's usually colder here than there. The one caveat is the 160-mile-an-hour winds, which sometimes come off the coast. I was walking to dinner one night and blown 40 feet, and I could have been severely injured because I literally landed on my head, but I had my ice climbing helmet because it had a big lamp on it, and it was dark at night, and so I wasn't injured. But that was unbelievably lifted and carried 40 feet by the wind, and then just when the gust stopped, dropped.
Over those years, what impacts have you seen?
Just incredible.
Life.
If you'd like, we could go over there and talk about this series of images. Maybe I should start with this one, and then we'll go there. Mm-hmm. But this is essentially how much water is melting, even in the dead of winter. It's coming off of these chunks of the glacier flowing into that lagoon, Jökulsárlón, which just means glacial lagoon. And that was once, in the 1700s, a farmer's field and a giant forest. That lagoon is now the deepest body of water in Iceland. So there's kind of a good example of just how much it's changed. Now, just a few years ago, with the guide I had mentioned, Einar, we found a piece of wood that was carbon dated to be 3,000 years old. So that was really nice. So we could kind of then mark when that forest was growing for sure, and the scientists were also excited about it. And because of that, we found it at the mouth of a cave. The cave became named Treasure Island because we had found this treasure. Now, if we step down here, we'll see a series that shows kind of the decay of, and when I do my talk, I'll show even a more complete picture of it to where all you see is rocks. But anyway, so this was my first ice cave I ever visited, and it was absolutely stupendous because of the waterfall going right through it. So you're looking at this incredible beauty. By the way, these open areas, they're referred to as moulons, and abrasive material, snow in the summer, rain, all sorts of, and of course light, which really helps, falls into the cave from the moulons. So anyway, this is a cave that was up 75 to about 100 yards long. And this would have been January 20th, 2016. Now, in the next one, we see what, not even a year later, where she's standing. This is really all that was left of that end of the cave. That would have been the south end of the cave. Now, at the north end, obviously when we see that there's just an arch, the middle had just completely vanished already. And that would have been by, again, just in that period of time, the whole middle vanished.
So this is ice, this is rock that's been...
Exactly. Wow. And this is ancient, of course, mm-hmm. and all that was left was this arch. And they were worried, the guides, that this was going to collapse and hurt somebody. But by the time they could get to it, it just crumbled. And then the final shot I show from this north end is nothing but the rocks. There is no more sign of ice. And for that, there's just this smoothed over gray area. You'd never even guess that there had ever been this massive ice cave there. And then I have...
So 11% of Iceland is still...
It depends who's measuring it. They're saying 8 to 11%. It's losing currently 40 kilometers a year of ice. And the models are continually being updated because it just keeps accelerating. And so the most pessimistic estimation of when all of the glaciers will be gone would be 80 years. The most optimistic is 200. But that...
Most optimistic.
Yeah, in the sense of they'll last for at least 200. And one of the reasons I chose this medium is it's archival. But at the same time, if we ever have to, and God perish the thought, it is recyclable aluminum. It's aircraft aluminum. It could be recycled. But I wanted to create it like this so for perhaps children in a couple of generations can see what a glacier looks like.
So are scientists running to you and saying, you know, these images are so important to what we're trying to convey?
Yes, and we've had this go around where I've said, now, and I was lucky to talk to one of the top scientists who started his research on this topic in 1953. The first time he went, two people were lost in a snowstorm and died. They've never found the bodies, but they did find all their equipment, and now it's in a museum there in Iceland at the National Park headquarters. But my questions or my comments to the scientists were, do you wish that you would have taken an easier to understand approach than charts, graphs, and all of this kind of technical, sanitary analysis and just show photographs? And I notice more and more now they are doing that. They're showing time lapse of the glacier eroding, and they're doing more aerials and marking things so that you can see how much it's gone back. But one of the projects that I'm still hoping to be able to do is to go back, and I started it a little bit, to where the guy photographed things in 1953 and document as closely as I can where he stood and where he shot these things. But quite honestly, I'm kind of out of money because this was done by myself and with the exception of the unions helping me. And it's 6 years just going back there. I mean, it's and finding places to stay. I mean, the guides were laughing at me when I said, I need a place to stay for 2 months in the winter. And the guy says, there's such a housing shortage. I'm staying in my truck. And he's a native of the country. So, but I was lucky enough because of that Icelandic Writers Union to find in 2 years in a row places I could stay. So,
a target of this particular installation is school children.
Yes.
Why is that so important to you?
The school children, that younger generation, is going to suffer the most. And they need to be brought up to speed and understand this, I think, so that they can prepare and recognize just what this means to them. And I think in a big way they already do, as evidenced by the 16-year-old from Sweden who spoke at the UN. But for somebody my age, 68, I mean, let's be honest, I haven't got a lot more years to live, but they're going to be putting up with this climate change for their lifetime. So I think it's really important to alert them to this. And the other thing that I was struck by is in Iceland, the young school children have prepared materials on climate change to give to the tourists from all the various countries who are coming there. So they just seem so much more ahead of us in being prepared and understanding the impact of climate change. The main reason I wanted to do this exhibition is every single one of us in the world is impacted by this. And everyone in this world is contributing to it as much as they would not want to. We are. I really want to use my photography, and I want to do it in a way that aesthetically people are interested in it, but I virtually always need a message to deliver about what the subject is, or I quite honestly don't want to do the project. And to me, the climate change will now be the rest of my life because it has, as I said, impact on every single human being on Earth.
So will you be meeting with school children in Milwaukee? And I know you're giving a number.
Yeah,
of...
the plan is, first, the teachers have come here. I've now spoken to, 45 or 50 teachers. They go back to the class. The ones that decide to come here and show the children this will receive a book that I've done on this project, and they will have that in class to kind of prepare the students and explain to them, here's what's going on. And then they will come and actually look at it, and some of them will be encouraged, well, all of them, as far as I'm concerned, will be encouraged to do their own drawings inspired by what they're seeing here, and to just start thinking about climate change. And I think it's wonderful. And the reason I love the arts at large is that it's not just something on the wall and we're going to walk away. It's something on the wall for us to contemplate, and let's do something with the sort of information that people grasp by viewing images. So when we first met, I said, this is the most perfect fit because this is what I think, for lack of a better word, art should do.
Iceland's Vanishing Beauty by photojournalist Michael Knitz can be seen in the Arts at Large Gallery through December 31st. You'll find more information about the exhibit and the photographer's body of work at WUWM.com. Knitz spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. We'll take one last break, then Shorewood High School grad and Broadway star Kate Baldwin joins us ahead of her performance this Saturday at Skylight Music Theater. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Broadway star and Tony Award nominee Kate Baldwin may live and work in New York City now, but she grew up in Milwaukee. Baldwin graduated from Shorewood High School, and it was there that she met the late Barbara Gensler and became involved in the school's acclaimed theater program. Baldwin was recently nominated for a Tony for her role as Irene Malloy in the revival of Hello, Dolly, which also starred Bette Midler and Bernadette Peters. Baldwin is back in Milwaukee to perform songs from her one-woman show, How Did You Get This Number?, at Skylight Music Theater's gala this Saturday. But she stopped by the studio first to talk with Lake Effect's Bonnie North.
Kate Baldwin, it is such a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks for coming in.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me.
Well, welcome back, first of all.
Thanks.
So you are back with this wonderful concert that I understand is kind of, you've done it in other places, you're taking it to other places. So what is it that you're trying to do with this?
Oh, that's fun. I call the concert, the title of it is How Did You Get This Number? And it talks about, I sort of structured it as an introduction. Even though I've worked and made my living doing theater and musical theater for about 22 years now, I find often I'm required to reintroduce myself over and over again to new groups of people. And I just had this wonderful experience of almost 2 years of working on Broadway in the revival of Hello, Dolly. And I played Irene Malloy, and I got to work with wonderful people like Bette Midler and David Hyde Pierce and Bernadette Peters and Victor Garber.
It was a terrific production, I have to say.
We loved it, and we loved doing it. But a lot of audiences... A lot of audience members who maybe were seeing that kind of show for the first time, or, you know, were Bette Midler fans who were brought in to see a show because of her, that who are you and why have I never heard of you before, or where did you come from, or what's your story? And so I thought about that, and I thought I should put together a one-woman show that sort of chronicles my journey through my professional career. And so the sort of explanation of the title is, these are songs, I've gathered songs that belong to me and I belong to them, either by way of being responsible for reintroducing them to the world in Broadway revivals, or being the first person to record them because they are from new musicals that were written when I was part of the original cast, or they're arrangements that were made specially for me because of a special event. So I've sort of gathered all these songs from, you know, 20 plus years of a career and put them together, hopefully with some fun jokes in the middle.
And costume changes? Will there be costume changes?
Well, if I leave the stage to go change my costume, what are you guys gonna do if you're
in the
audience? So I don't have like a side act or anything.
I was gonna say, somebody can't come out and just hand you something that you could.
I could. I mean, maybe I should think about that a little bit more. But I get so wrapped up in singing and talking and that I don't want to and relating to the audience that I don't want to leave.
Sure.
No. Yeah.
You talked about people not knowing who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is such a thing as musical theater fanatic fans. You know, people who love musical theater and know everything about everyone. And then there's everyone else who might know some big names. But it does seem like musical theater has crossed over into more mainstream with people like Bette Midler going to it and David Hyde Pierce going to it, although I'm sure a lot of them have some musical theater background, but that's not how they made their fame.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you find that there is that kind of crossover happening more now where people like yourself who have been very firmly in that camp are now, you know, expanding out into different audiences with different ideas and perspectives?
Well, you know, it is funny. We were staging the curtain call for Dolly, and we were all, you know, lined up and ready to do it. And Bette turned to me at that point. She said, "Is this all you do? You just do musicals? This is all?" And I said, "Bette, this is all I've ever wanted to do was musical theater." You know, and where she's had this varied career of like film and television and concert work and all that kind of stuff. I do think that, you know, like sports fans or musical theater fans, there are groups of people or a specific group of people to whom my work is important and to whom I mean something. And then likewise with, you know, sports fans or other like classical music fans, they have their people that they follow. But what I like to see, and I think what you're talking about and what we're seeing more of, is sort of mainstream pop culture following more about musical theater with shows like Smash or Glee, sort of a broadened awareness of musical theater and musical theater history. And I hope that it's reaching, I know that it's reaching a new generation because there are more and more teenagers now that I see who have access to YouTube YouTube and have access to Spotify and who can become familiar with the work, with musicals, in a more fluid and easier and accessible way than I could when I was starting out. I needed to go to, Musicland and buy the cassette tape and then learn about it.
Or go to the library.
Get
the LP.
Or talk to somebody who was a number of years older than me who would say, listen to this, or follow this person's career. Here's Barbara Cook. Maybe you should listen to her because, you have similarities in your voice. So I think what's cool about it is that there's more accessibility for young people now.
It also seems to be more acceptable. And it's like Glee, I think, had a lot to do with that, where it made being a musical theater geek cool.
I hope so. I don't know, because I'm firmly entrenched in the geekdom. I'm proud of, of my nerdiness.
Card-carrying geek.
That's right. That's right. Well, I also think to myself, gosh, isn't it amazing how much time and resources and money is dedicated to telling stories in our culture, whether it's film or television or on stage. We love a story. We, as human beings, that's something we crave. We need to feel connected to one another, to understand another person's point of view, to maybe stand inside another person's shoes for a minute. It breeds empathy and understanding and connectedness, and that's what I always come back to when, it's the eighth show of the week and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired, I can't do this anymore. And I think to myself, wait a second, there's a person who bought a ticket and who's sitting out there and wants to have an experience where they can be entertained, where they can think about something that they may not have thought about before, where we can hopefully open a door to some understanding. It's what I hope that theater does and musical theater can do.
So why was musical theater the thing that you always wanted to do? What was it about it?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think from a very young age, I was always singing. My mom tells a story about my mother and father. I think they went on a business trip or something for a weekend and left me and my younger brother in the care of their dear friends from college. And when my mom came back from the business trip, her, best friend who had been taking care of us had said, well, Kate's a hummer. She sings all the time. And my mom was like, what? She's like, don't all, 6-year-old girls sing all the time? She said, no, your child does this all the time. So there was always music in my head. I remember taking the SATs and trying to stop the musical theater songs that were going through my head because I needed to focus on the problem or the geometry problem that was right in front of me, because it was always in the ether. I was always sort of absorbing it. And I always found it fascinating and fun to listen to music, to try to get inside of it and to try to replicate it and reproduce it. So music for me was always hugely important. And then for theater, it was the whole question of what makes a person do the things that they do. And that's what theater concerns itself with. That's what acting concerns itself with. It's at the point of view of somebody who's not like you. I think because I had such a wonderful, sheltered, protected childhood in Shorewood, Wisconsin, I was so well taken care of, and I hungered for what is it like in other places? What do other people go through? What is that about? A person's struggle or a person's strife, and I became curious about really understanding why people do what they do.
Yeah, and how can I understand it better?
Yeah. How can I feel what they're feeling? Mm-hmm. What's their perspective on all of that? So I think it was just curiosity and a fascination with human behavior. It all starts, with observation. I was saying this morning that my dad and my brother are two of the best human observers I've ever seen in my life. They can pick out a person's, body language and tone of voice. And, we're always communicating that way. My acting teacher in college always said, almost 90% of what we communicate is nonverbal. And then of the remaining 10%, something like half of it is tone of voice. So really only 5% is content.
Oh, is it tone of voice and pausing?
Yes, right. Right. So if you break it down in that sort of scientific way, I started to really get fascinated by how we relate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and musical theater gives you that option of, it's like opera, in that it has all of the art forms mixed into it.
Yes.
So you have lots of different ways of exploring that connection that, why does this person do this?
Right.
You mentioned earlier some of the songs that are going to be part of this gala concert are songs that you were the first one to sing. Mm-hmm. It was something that was written in a musical that was brand new. Mm-hmm. How do you feel modern musicals are doing? Are they healthy?
Oh, yes. Oh, I think they're alive and well. I think there are so many young and prolific writers out there that are working, are getting grants, are continuing to produce new stuff. And we only see a fraction of it in commercial theater, I think. And part of that is because producers of Broadway musicals want to have a successful show, and there are certain things that they know will make a successful show. If you put Bette Midler or Hugh Jackman in your musical, you're going to make money. It helps when it's a classic like Hello, Dolly, or like Music Man that's coming up with Hugh Jackman next season. But, you know, there are other more experimental and works like Hadestown that just won the Tony Award this year that came from like a concept album written by a woman named Anais Mitchell and went through years and years of development off-Broadway and in smaller houses and regional theaters and have taken sort of that circuitous path to Broadway and to commercial, what we hope will be commercial success, and really just to reach a wider audience. So yes, what I love about Broadway is that there are the sort of like tried and true revivals of stalwart shows, and then there is room for new and innovative work that is really getting pushed to the forefront by producers who get really committed and are very good at supporting and raising money for new work. I think it's alive and well.
And it's interesting, you know, it'll be interesting to see who the names are in 10 or 15 years, the way people in my generation looked at Hal Prince, Stephen Sondheim, Kander and Ebb. Those were all the folks who were doing it.
Yep.
At, you know, in the 60s and the 70s mm-hmm. and up until very, very recently in the case mm-hmm. of Hal Prince. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and I think we look at those titans of the theater and we think, wow, everything they did was a huge success. And what you realize if you study them for a while is that they had a great success but also great flops. And these are people who were less afraid of failure. They would try new stuff and it would either go or it wouldn't. I mean, you and I were talking about one of our favorite musicals, Follies, right before we went on microphone here, but that was a huge flop. It did not make money. It was a financial, you know,
catastrophe.
Yeah. But it produced some of the most what I consider iconic songs of musical theater and I think has enjoyed successful revivals since then and is such a worthwhile and meaningful piece of art that gets produced all over the place in different countries, in different cities and has a worthwhile story to tell.
I think sometimes the fear is that nobody will bankroll it because
yeah.
it's so expensive to produce a show on Broadway. You know, there you have to have really deep pockets. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you hope that you get some of that back
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because it's millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the pressure is on, of course, to the creators of the musical, to the cast of that new musical, you know, to really be everything all the time.
Yeah. And it used to be, probably about 10 years ago, it used to be that a show could receive fair reviews but have time to find their audience. I think Wicked is a classic example of a show that maybe didn't get rave reviews. Wasn't considered a hit right out of the gate. However, it took the time and had some really smart producing to find their audience and to gain word of mouth and become this smash hit phenomenon.
It's like a juggernaut
now.
Yeah,
juggernaut now. Yeah. But it was given that a year or so to become that. Now it seems to me, this is just my opinion, but now it seems to me you're either a smash hit right out of the gate or you close after 3 months. You know, it's that feast or famine kind of reflective of our economy in the United States, you know, where there's income inequality and there's, you know, wage gap and all kinds of things. So it seems to me to be following, you know, sort of what's happening in our country. But it is that it's you're either, you know, boffo at the box office or you—
Day one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Day one. There's no time.
Yeah. Yeah there's no time to build an audience.
Yeah.
And so that's why something like Hadestown I find very hopeful because it had this sort of roundabout way of getting to where it got to. And we had a producer and a group of people who really committed to it and saw it through. And I find that so exciting.
So for the you that's now at Shorewood or any other small high school in the United States wanting to break into musical theater, what would you offer them?
I have no idea. It's so different now than it was when I was in high school, you know. So it's even different now from I moved to New York 20 years ago, and it's breaking into the musical theater world and finding an agent and getting to know casting directors is so different now than it was.
The social media, for one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still a mystery to me. I'm terrible at social media. I don't know how you are, but.
Not very good. I'm too old.
Same. I don't think about it. It's not a big part of my day. It really should be. I'm really behind the curve on that one. I should do much better. But I don't know. I really don't know. That's not my line of advice giving. I could give you advice on how to sing your song and what, you know, repertoire to choose and maybe what shoes to wear. But I can tell you.
That's important too.
It is.
That's really important to understand to help a young singer find the things that are going to work with their voice.
Right. And to know that if you only have 3 or 4 minutes in front of a casting director or in front of an agent, your song choice says a lot about you. So the composer that you choose, you know, the idea that you're putting over, as much as your performance of it speaks to who you are and tells them something about you.
Kate Baldwin is an acclaimed Broadway actor and graduate of Shorewood High School. She will be back in Milwaukee this Saturday to perform songs from her one-woman show, How Did You Get This Number?, at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. She spoke with Bonnie North, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's and PR.
Have lights, we'll dim. Have disc, we'll spin. Have bet, we'll get him. Have hunch, we'll win. Now all I need is a chance. Have song, have arms, have lips. Have date, have feet, we'll dim.